In the middle of Mishlei, Perek Chav Ches, 28, chapter 28. I continue, by the way, to researching what we're going to do for Eshes Chayil. I have big plans that may or may not ever happen, but they're big, for me at least. Yeah, that's all right. I would do it differently. Okay, we are in Perek Chav Ches, Pasuk Chav Aleph, 28, 21. Haker panim lo tov. It's an interesting phrase. Haker panim lo tov. Usually if something's bad, and he'll actually use this word later on, you'll say the word, what word means bad? Ra. Right? Lo tov is an interesting use of the word. Where else do we find lo tov? When's the first time we have that phrase, I think? First time in Tanakh we have that phrase? Lo tov. Right? Lo tov hayosa adam levado. Not good for man to be alone. Mazel tov to the Barths, relative to that pasuk on the occasion of Rivka's engagement. Mirtz Hashem, I should build a bayis nema b'Yisrael. So the word lo tov, the words lo tov are an interesting choice. Haker panim, what does haker panim mean? Haker panim literally means you recognize a person's face. But in context, and especially in sort of, I guess, Torah, hakaras panim means you're giving favor, you're showing favor to somebody, especially in a court of law. As it said here, showing favoritism in judgment, which is interesting. None of those words are in the actual pasuk, but that's what the article. Showing favoritism in judgment is not good. Lo tov. It's not ra, but it's lo tov. Why is it just lo tov? There are different ways you could approach this, but usually lo tov to me means there is no possibility of good. Nothing good can come from it. As opposed to saying that it's bad, bad is almost like it is inherently evil. Bribery is bad. Hakaras panim is sort of like smiling at somebody. Is that a bad thing? You know, we can't call smiling at someone bad. Hakaras panim, you're giving them, you know, a favoritism by the way that you're looking at them. Hakaras panim. So it's not bad. But it's also not good either. If you're a judge, you shouldn't be saying good morning to one party and not good morning to the other party. Because nothing good can come out of it, right? Maybe it won't be bad, but it definitely won't be good. And then the pasuk says, V'al paslechem yifshagaver, that even, and that's a drasha, Rashi says, no. V'al paslechem, even, that's how I'm going to say it, even a piece of bread will cause man to sin. Even a piece of bread will cause man to sin. This is presumably explaining the first part. Giving someone some favoritism, just a facial expression, hakaras panim, you're giving them a good look. That's lo tov. And you never know, because even one small piece of bread can make a person feel favoritism. So the truth is that it's not clear what the problem is. What is the ultimate issue? So the Gemara in Shavua says that the problem is possibly that the opponent, meaning not the one that you're showing favoritism to, but the other person, will start to feel like, oh, what's the point? What's the point? The judge is already ruling against me. And you'll find this sometimes, especially in sports. Oh, the refs, you know, the referees, or the umpires, they have it out for me, and then you don't play as well because you think everyone's out to get you. You're playing the victim card, and eventually, and studies show this actually, eventually you assume the role of the victim. We'll get into that later a little bit, but that's one person that might be affected by this. The opponent, the one who's not being favored by the judge, is going to feel, what's the point? What's the use? And they're not going to give their best. They're not going to put their best foot forward. Alternatively, in the opposite but equal direction, the person who's being favored is also going to similarly say, oh, we don't have to try so hard. The judge is on our side. My dad is friends with the judge. Whatever, you know. You feel like you're favored, and therefore you're not going to put your best foot forward. And then that person is not going to do as well. I think that's what the Mesudas David says. The Mesudas David says this word, Ritzono Lomar. Sorry, that's the second one. Lo tov l'dayin l'hakir p'nei achad v'chavdo. Ki b'zeh yistatmu ta'anos baldino. B'chashvo she das hadayin k'rova ilav. Thanks, Chana. We are up to 28:21. Right? You think, you're welcome, you think, as the plaintiff, you think the judge is siding with you. And you'll believe in him that he's going to, that you're going to trust him, that he's going to put you through in a positive verdict. So that's two ways of understanding either the opponent or the person that's being favored is going to try less. And that's also, I think, ties into the lo tov. I can't tell you that it's necessarily going to be bad, but one of two things could happen. This person's not going to try as hard, or the other side's not going to try as hard. It could be that they both don't try as hard, or it could be that neither of them, you know, less than how much they try because of the favoritism. But the point is, nothing good can come of it. Lo tov. I've thought about this, I thought a little bit about this last phrase, V'yal paslacham yifshagaver. I think, and this is a drasha, this is not pshat, but there are some interesting studies that came out in the last decade, out of Israel, actually, in the court systems in Israel. They conducted a study. I just read it in a book recently, although I don't remember what book it was, but I remember reading it also in Daniel Kahneman's book called Noise, his first book that we used to quote all the time called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is sort of like the Bible of modern day psychology. To me, at least, I've seen his ideas pop up everywhere. So that's the first one we've thought about. We've quoted from a lot. That's what that one he did with Amos Tversky. The second one, Noise, I think he did with a guy named Cass Sunstein, whose book Range we've quoted from before. He wrote that with Richard Thaler. I think that's the one, and I don't remember now. It was either Range or it was Nudge. I can't remember. Either way, so he writes this book, Noise. Noise is not the study of biases, because that's really, he talked a lot about biases and thinking fast and slow. Noise, his book called Noise, is about all the other ancillary stuff that goes on in our life that affects our decisions. I mean, it's not a bias because I want something to happen, but it sways our decision-making process because of who knows what. You know, you were, I don't know if people know, familiar with the concept of anchoring. You saw a number, and then you know, anchoring is the concept of, like, if you are, I think this actually might have been in Think Fast and Slow, now that I'm thinking about it. If you're in a negotiation, right, and you have no idea. It's just happened, not that I was negotiating, but I was just talking to somebody, and we were talking about a certain price of a certain thing, and they were the first person to say a number. And then after that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess it's around there. I thought it was higher, but I guess it's around there. Right? Because he anchored me in that. The truth is, it was four times as much, the price. But he anchored me. Right? There are all these studies that talk, how old was Gandhi when he died? And you throw out like a random number. It doesn't matter what the number is. It could be absolutely bogus. You could say like 500, and the person's number after that will be anchored by that. Meaning, a person's not going to say 500, but instead of saying 80, they'll say 90. Right? So that kind of thing. So that's a kind of anchoring. Things that happen in our environment or things that happen outside of us that cause us to change our decisions. So one of the interesting studies that came out of Israel that I believe Kahneman talks about, and it was really, I guess, I read it in a book recently also. He talks about how judges give more lenient sentences in direct proportion to the last time they ate. Last time they ate food. It's a fascinating study. If the court cases that are done earlier on, right after breakfast, they're more prone to giving lighter sentences and probationary sentences as opposed to actual prison time. The ones right before lunchtime, they've got it the worst. The ones right after lunchtime, they've got it easy again, right? The extent that so that made me think, this pasuk made me think of that study, right? This last clause, v'yal paslechem yifshagaver. And on account of a little bit of bread, man will sin, meaning that the judge will sin, because they won't be thinking clearly if they don't have that bread, or maybe too little bread. Pas lechem here could be a reference to how little.
Lechem seems to me to mean bread.
Say again?
Pat lechem.
Oh, pa, right. The word bread, yes. Lechem means bread, and pas means bread. But in this case, pas lechem means like a slice of bread. Yeah, you're right. Usually pas means like a, I think it literally means slice, if I'm not mistaken. That's a different word, but yeah. Yeah. So,
Prusa
sounds similar, but the letters are actually very different. Okay. Could be. So so that's what I thought of with that pasuk. Al pas lechem yefshagaver, if he has too small of a meal beforehand, it might affect how he's going to adjudicate the case. Not that he's going to show favoritism, but just not being nourished properly. And that's, you know, important for us to realize, because I think, you know, a lot of times we get in a mood and we're like, why are we so upset? Why aren't we, you know, I'm usually able to do my homework with my kids, you know. I'm usually able to do bath time properly. Obviously, I'm giving examples from my own life, but you can think of your own things. I'm usually able to focus more on my Shmoneh Esrei. I'm usually able to get along better with my colleagues. And then you remember, oh, I didn't have breakfast this morning. You know, and we don't even realize that our brains are wired in certain ways, that they depend on the certain nutrients.
Or you didn't have enough sleep.
Sleep also.
Very interesting.
Yeah, Henry.
In your point, but could it not mean like not a bribe, but, you know, like giving the teacher an apple?
I mean, yeah. I think that's the point of the pasuk. Even a small slice of bread, that's the pshat. My idea is not the pshat. I get that. Mine was a separate idea. But yes, the pshat of the pasuk, although Mitzvah Sevet has a different read, he thinks it's a rhetorical question. But the pshat of the pasuk is even the smallest amount of food, even if it's not like a big gift, like a, you know, apple to the teacher, like you're saying, a small slice of bread can sway a person's judgment. Okay, an interesting thought. Pasuk Chaf Beis, Nivahal Lahon. Nivahal Lahon is an interesting phrase. It means basically like you're going crazy for money. How does it translate? David, do you have one? Distracted? I have over-eager.
He says a miserly man runs after wealth, but that doesn't seem like a good translation.
Miserly, with an R?
Miserly.
Okay.
I don't get that.
It means that they want a lot of money. They want a lot of money. That's what it all means, the same thing. Okay. That they want to keep all their money.
I think miserly is the Ishra'ayin.
That could be. Yeah, no, that could definitely be. So someone who's nivahal lahon, say the whole phrase in yours, Sarita.
Oh, yeah, that's right. A man may do wrong for a piece of bread. A miserly man runs after wealth.
Yeah, that's the runs after. Okay. Nivahal lahon means you're chasing after, you're over-eager for money. Mm-hmm. So then the one who does that is an Ishra'ayin. You can say it in both ways. You can say the one who does that is an Ishra'ayin, or you're saying an Ishra'ayin is the one who does that. It's basically the same thing. But So the ra'ayin is an interesting phrase, right? We use that phrase almost in the opposite sometimes, right? Ayin hara, whatever that means, right? An ayin hara. Yeah. Ayin hara. Kanayin hara. Without, you know, no ayin hara. Yeah. Kanayin hara. I find it a little humorous oftentimes in like the wrong settings. I find it a little humorous how people use the word kanayin hara or the phrase kanayin hara. I was at a funeral. And the person was talking about the deceased and said, "Oh, they're 95 years. They were 95 years old." Kanayin hara. So, like, I don't think it means what you think it means. Yeah. Anyways.
Use it. They spoke Yiddish.
Yeah, kanayin hara means without an ayin hara that they should die. You know, and the person had already dead. Whatever. So kanayin hara. So that's ayin hara. What does ayin hara mean? It's unclear. In this case, I'm not really sure. It's the same ayin hara that we're talking about. It could be. That's how it's applied. It's applied in envious, and that's what we're talking about here, basically. Some people, depending on context, ayin hara could be the yetzer hara, or ayin hara could be, or it could be stinginess, like miserliness, right? Ayin hara, it depends on the context, really. It's just one of these like amorphous terms. So ayin hara here in this context presumably means someone who is eager for money is a person with an evil eye, meaning, like Sarita is saying, pshat is probably, they don't want to give anybody any money. So that's probably a pshat. There are other possibilities, though. What was the other one I saw?
And distracted by his wealth as the miser, he is unaware that want will come upon him.
That's the end of us. So what's the first part? Distracted by his wealth
as the miser.
That's an interesting, because the word nivahal, I was thinking about that. The word nivahal, the word is not nivahal or yivahal lahon. It's nivahal, which almost sounds reflexive or passive. One who is, you know, hastened, or one who is, you know, made to act hastily. Nivahalik, it's reflexive. Anyways, I thought about that type of understanding. Yeah. So nivahalahon ishra ayin. That type of person is ishra ayin. That could either mean he's miserly, or it can mean, as David said before, he's envious, which is two sides of the same coin. I mean, it either means he doesn't want to give anybody anything to anyone, or he wants from other people what they have. Right? So that's the two possibilities. That's more like an ayin hara that we typically say. When you put an ayin hara on someone, it means, you know, something bad's going to happen to them. Not that you're going to get something good, right? That's not envy necessarily. It's not envy. You want them to fail or something like that.
Misery loves company.
Yeah. If I'm bad, you're going to be bad with me. Yeah. But then with that perspective, v'lo yedaki cheser yivoenu, that the person doesn't know that ultimately lacking will come. Now, that's a more generic and literal way of translating it. How do you translate it, David? The end of it? You said it before. The end of 20.
He's unaware that want will come.
Want. Okay, so lacking. Same thing.
Lacking.
Cheser, which is an interesting form of that verb. But ki cheser yivoenu.
It's a noun here.
Yeah, exactly. Usually it means, it depends how it's used, but yeah. Cheser yivoenu, lacking will come. So how do we understand it? The Ralbag, I believe, has an interesting phrase that I wanted to quote. Hinei ha'ish ha'kili noheg bekilut l'chashvo shikne bezeh hon biyoter. I don't know how to translate the word kili, but I assume it means someone who is greedy. I really don't know the word kili. Chaf yud lamed yud. Hakili noheg bechilut l'chashvo shiyikne bezeh hon biyoter. If you're so greedy and stingy, you think that you're going to get more and more money. That's how you learn. Ma'at mehazman, with less time, v'lo hirgish, but they don't feel, they don't appreciate. Ki zot hatzchuna hapchuta, that lower level approach is siba sheyivoehu chaser. That exact mentality, that perspective, is itself what is going to lose you money in the end. Ke'en le'ish kazeh ohavim. Because that kind of person does not have any friends. U'lezeh yitachin sheyikru lo nezakim v'hafsedim. And because of that perspective, bad things will happen. People won't be washing out. He won't have the support system that he needs. He won't be able to make the deals that he needs to make. We've talked about this in the past, but not in a while. Adam Grant has a wonderful book, his first real big book called Give and Take. He was a professor. He's a professor at Wharton, but I think he has a master's from Michigan, U of M. And and he talks about give and take, where who are the least successful business people are the ones that are givers. They're the least successful. They just give too much away. They're unable. But who are the most successful? Also givers. The people that are willing to give to other people. The trick is not should you be a giver or a taker. The trick is what kind of giver are you? Takers are always no good. They always start out very good. And that's what it's saying here, right? That you think you're going to gain money, and you do in the short term. You'll gain money by cutting corners, by not treating people nicely, by maybe, you know, what's it called? Not manipulating, leveraging other people and using them for your own benefit. But ultimately, you will knock off friends one by one, and you'll burn every bridge, and you'll never be able to recover those bridges. People like that, you know, don't trust you anymore. And sooner or later, the resources will dry out. The resources in your field to make more money, to work with other people, are going to dry out. And ultimately, chaser yivoenu, ultimately that taking lifestyle is going to lead to the exact opposite of what your hope is. So this is one of those classic reminders of, you know, short-term, long-term thinking. In the short term, it might work out for you, but in the long term, it's actually better off to be kinder, to be nicer, to be more giving, not to be a doormat, but to be more giving, and that will ultimately lead to ultimately lead toward to more wealth. And that's just in a sort of a practical way. Besides the fact that it's just not right, you know, but Shlomo Melech is speaking to the person that's greedy. So even it's almost like in Gemara we say lishitascha, even according to you, even according to you, who you want to make more money, it's better to treat people nicely to make more money, right? Even that, even within your perspective, if you want to make more money, you should be kinder. There's also matchers, by the way. There's givers, there's takers, and then there's matchers. Matchers are sort of like in the middle. Matchers are people who don't just give because they like giving, but don't just take because they, you know, they want to take from other people. They'll match you. They're just like fair. You gave me, I gave you. Scratch your back, scratch my back, type of thing. Okay. Moving on to Pasuk Chaf Gimel. We've talked about this a lot, and this is a wonderful encapsulation of an idea we've said a few times. Mochiach, Shlomo HaMelech has said a few times, Mochiach Adam Acharai, that's an interesting word, Mochiach Adam Acharai, Chein Yimtza. If you rebuke a person, properly, of course, so then, afterwards, Chein Yimtza, which is an interesting word, Acharai. Acharai usually means after me or after us. Here, I think it just means after. But what's interesting is it's not right away. And that's, I think, the operative word. As opposed to mimachalik lashon, as opposed to the smooth tongue. What is a smooth tongue? Sometimes smooth tongues means like a tricker, someone who's you know, scheming or pulling the wool over your eyes. How do you, what are the translations we have? Flattery, good. That's what I was thinking. Is that what you have also, Sarita? At the end of 23? Better than a?
Yeah, it does say flatter.
Flatterer, yeah. Flatter what?
Find more favor than he who flatters him.
Flatters him, good. So think about it this way. And I recently spoke to somebody about this in terms of like helping with their, you know, raising their kid and stuff. But Dr. David Pelkovitz talks about, and he probably has much better material now than when I heard it from him 5 years ago or whatever it was. But Dr. David Pelkovitz, he's a professor at the Furkoff School at YU, which is about psychology. And he had done a lot of research into the effects of smartphones on kids. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the real heavy anxiety that's caused by it, which is absolutely true. But he talks about parenting and phones. And he says that most kids, I don't remember exactly the proportions that he said, but he said many kids, when they grow up after using a cell phone in high school, they at some point sort of express some level of regret and even disdain to their parents that they didn't stop them from using cell phones. That they grew up and they saw like what the cell phones did to them as teenagers and how they related to other people and how they became, you know, judgmental and stuff like that. More importantly, he said, the kids who did not have the privileges of a cell phone, specifically a smartphone, and didn't have as much social media, invariably, he said, all of them thanked their parents. All of them are grateful that they didn't have it. Now, I grew up at a time where, like, it wasn't really a thing. I was, like, right at the precipice. You know, I think the iPhone came out in, like, 2008, something like that, which was, like, sort of the breakthrough of social media because you could have it at all times in your hand. Before that was the BlackBerry. I don't know if people remember the BlackBerry. All of us own. The BlackBerry basically was, you know, very cheap. You couldn't really use it for anything, you know, besides text. That you could, but it wasn't very, you know, usable. But so I really grew up before the social media craze in terms of having it accessible all the time. But I was grateful to my parents for not giving me any kind of smartphone. I mean, it wasn't, you know, much. But when I got into college, I didn't have a smartphone until I was dating Ricky. I didn't have a smartphone. I just had a regular texting phone.
A smartphone until 2 or 3.
Yeah, I'm sure you didn't. Yeah, yeah, right.
Very hard to text on
there. Yeah, you got to do the T9 or whatever. It was a fun time. Yeah, right. Yeah, no, you guys grew up without it. So, but my point is that I went through Israel with all my friends getting these phones. And I went through college with all my friends getting these phones. And it wasn't until the end of college that I actually got one myself. I went, you know, watching all my friends for 5 years get smartphones and I never had it. You know, some of that was financial. Some of it was necessity. Some of it was just I didn't want that, you know, kind of thing in my life. Now I have it, and I see the benefits of not having it, but obviously I see the benefits of having it too.
Facebook, and Aaron realized herself that it was
detrimental.
It was detrimental to her because she was, using it, and then you fixed all these likes and dislikes and people saying things. And she says, I can't have that, and she stopped.
Good for her.
Completely. I mean, herself. She didn't. It wasn't because anything we said to her. Because she just decided herself.
That's the best way to do it. Yeah, to find it, figure it out yourself. Mm-hmm. My point is that sometimes, when you make that decision for a teenager, they are not happy, and they will be very upset, and they will be, lash out at you. You have to have a certain level of foundation with that teenager in order to make this kind of discipline work. But what you'll find is, as David Feckovitz says, acharai, afterwards, Rashi, in the words of Rashi, la'achar zman, after a bunch of time, chen yimtza be'enav yosrim imachlik lashon, they will be loved more than those who try to flatter. What does it mean to flatter? Flattery means, in this context, that you are sort of just saying, oh yeah, you can do it. You can do whatever you want. You're doing a great job. This is, as we've talked about before, one of the main issues of relationships today. I don't mean like close relationships. Hopefully close relationships are stronger than this. I mean day-to-day relationships, talking to people face-to-face. People don't want to insult anyone. People don't want to, and I don't mean like they would insult them, but I mean, don't want them to be insulted, right? Jonathan Haidt has a wonderful but scary book called The Coddling of the American Mind. I recently read a sort of a takeoff of that book, which has a foreword from Jonathan Haidt, which is called The Canceling of the American Mind, which is, just takes to the next level. I'm sure people know what I'm talking about already.
The takeoff on Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American
Mind. It could be. Yeah, that could be in an older book. But it could be Coddling, Closing, I hear that. But he talks about how we used to be a people, I don't want to get into sensational critiques, but it used to be that you could have conversations and critique and whatever, and now, the values of America are basically don't hurt anybody. There's no unifying value anymore, that we can sort of say, oh, this is an American value. Right? The one and only value for most people is don't hurt anybody else. And that means verbally too. And that comes along with all these different things we don't have to get into politically. But, so I think this is the pasuk that encapsulates that. Mocheach Adam, you discipline a person, it's not going to be pretty, especially if you don't have a good relationship with them. But Mocheach Adam, acharai chen yimtza. You should be confident in the fact, if you tell a person what they need to hear, and you have a good relationship, that it's not going to be too devastating for them. After a while, chen yimtza, they might be upset about it. They might be saddened by it. But ultimately, chen yimtza, that person will favor you. They will appreciate what you did for them in disciplining them, in showing them the proper path, even if that in that moment they didn't see it that way. That's much better than a machlik lashon. Machlik lashon is a euphemism for than what America is doing, right? In America, we are all machlik lashon. We're a bunch of flatterers, right? The society that we live in is basically one long endeavor to make everyone else feel good. Machlik lashon. Oh yeah, you can do that. Oh, that crazy thing that just 20 years ago we would have called you crazy for it. You can do that. That's fine. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, so I don't have to go into the unfortunate details of it. But you know what I'm saying? Machlik lashon. Whatever anybody chooses as their lifestyle, good for us. We'll just make them feel good about it. That's machlik lashon. Everything's making you feel good. And while it doesn't seem clear and obvious how it connects to the next pasuk, it really does connect to the next pasuk. We'll talk about it in a second. I'm using it in terms of child rearing, which is what the next pasuk is talking about. But you can use it in other contexts too. Just to refresh our memory, we've talked in the past about Brené Brown's Daring to Lead book, where she talks about the importance of rumbling, where in her, at least she claims, she tries to rumble with her colleagues and her employees that we're going to have a difficult conversation now. Everyone put their big boy pants on. We're going to say some things that might be, a little bit offensive, but it's for the betterment of the company. And now we're going to have a hard conversation. Almost like she introduces it that way. She prepares them, and now she just says what they call it, rumbling. We're going to rumble. Nothing personal. We're just trying to be better as a company. And that sometimes can mean critiquing each other so that we can come better. But it's not out of hate, it's out of love, right? And that's her way of saying it, you know, rumbling. We've talked in the past also about the power of the other by, I think it's Charles Duhigg, about the different types of relationships, corner one relationships, you know, corner two relationships. The corner four is when you're able to criticize a person and still have a relationship. That's corner four. That's the best, the pinnacle type of relationship is when you could be mochiach. Mochiach adam acharai chen yimtza. That you can discipline them, you can critique them, and then ultimately you'll be able to have that favoritism again. You'll have that friendship. It won't be lost. But moving on to Pasuk Chaf Ches Chaf Dalet, 28:24. Gozel aviv v'imo v'yomar ein pesha. Maybe some parents would relate to this. If a child steals from their father or their mother, and they say to them, "So, oh, there's nothing wrong with that." Why would they say there's nothing wrong with that? You're supposed to support me, right? You're supposed to take care of me. You're supposed to put a roof over my head and clothe me and give me food to eat, right? So gozel aviv v'imo v'yomar ein pesha. A person, a child says, you know, I can take my parents' money, and there's nothing wrong with that. So then, chaver hu l'ish mashkis. Very interesting phrasing. I don't think we've seen this from Shlomo Melech before. Chaver hu means he's a friend of, he's similar to, you know, he's akin to an ish mashkis, a destructive person. Now, there are a bunch of things we could say about this. One thing we can say about this is what I would call a chefta gavra question. Sometimes we look at the world, unfortunately, as result-oriented activities. Everything is result-oriented, right? In the end of the day, does this person have what they need and does this person have what they need? It doesn't matter how we got there. Did people get what they needed to get? Okay, that's one way of looking at the world. And the other way of looking at the world is not did the result, you know, produce what we wanted, but did I do the best that I could do, regardless of the result? Meaning the result doesn't matter. It's all about making the right decisions, whether that comes out, you know, properly or not. You know, a lot of people can appreciate this. Maybe Evan can appreciate this. Sort of like fantasy football. This happens all the time in like betting or sports. You know, when people nowadays, it's a huge industry, and I kind of honestly scared about it. But you know, I should have played this person. I should have bet that bet. But they say that after the bet was already given, right? So it's like no, the fact that it didn't turn out in your favor doesn't mean that you should have done differently before. If you did differently before, that means you would have won, but that doesn't make the decision any different. The result is independent of the correct decision process, right? So for instance, I'll take it out of sports for a second. If there is a 70% chance something's going to happen and a 30% chance that it's not going to happen, the correct decision is to decide something based on the 70%. Now, it might be that the 30%, it happens 3 out of 10 times, the 30%, you know, is true. Right, so for instance, if it says 70% chance of raining, okay, so should I bring my umbrella? Well, there's 30% chance it's not going to rain, but you should bring your umbrella, 70% chance, and then it doesn't rain. So does that mean you shouldn't have brought the umbrella? No, of course you should have still, the decision was still the right decision, even if the result was different, right?
I buy fire insurance on my house, even though it doesn't burn down.
Yeah, exactly. That's insurance a little different because the rates are so low, but whatever. The point is...
But you buy it even though...
Right, very, very little option. Yeah, that's true. You have to cover both bases.
You shouldn't say, oh, I want to collect on it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Either way... So my point is that you can look at things result-oriented or you can look at them decision-oriented. And I think that's what Shlomo Melech might be getting. This is just one small point. Gozel aviv v'imo, you might think, oh, I'm taking it from my parents. My parents were going to give me that money anyway. I was going to need that money for food anyway. I was going to need that money to buy a new shirt anyway. So it doesn't make a difference. When I act with other people, so then it's not that big of a deal. Because the other people, I'm not going to steal from them. They're not responsible to pay for my food. They're not responsible. But so the result would be different. Therefore, I won't steal from them. Says Shlomo Melech, it's not true. Chaver hu l'ish mashkis. What he's saying is you're just like the destructive person. Why are you just like the destructive person? Because it's not dictated by results. It's not dictated by outcomes or by who you're wronging. You are now becoming a person who steals. Doesn't matter who you're stealing from. Doesn't matter the result. Doesn't matter if it's your parents or somebody else. You have now, that person has now become a thief. I remember, I think I quoted this recently from the Katzke Rebbe. The Katzke Rebbe was once overheard, Baruch Hashem, for snooping Hasidim. That was once overheard, the Katzker was learning Chumash, and he was explaining the Pesukim of the Aseres Adibros. Now the truth is the Aseres Adibros, you know, this line in Aseres Adibros is referring to kidnapping, but one of the Aseres Adibros is Lo Tignovu, don't steal, which is really kidnapping, but we're not going to get into that. And he heard the Katzker Rebbe say, Lo Signov, and in Yiddish, I'll just say it in English, or Hebrew, I'll say it in English, in Hebrew, he says, Lo Signov Al Tihi Ganav, which is an interesting phrase. Lo Signov, which means don't steal, he translated that to mean, don't be a thief. Because it's not about actually stealing. It's about the person that you are. So the person who steals from their parents, maybe it's not that bad, they were going to give you that money anyway. But now you're a thief. You've become that kind of person. So yes, maybe for your parents you're going to be lenient, but then later on, you'll come up with another excuse to steal from somebody else. Because that's the person you're becoming when you act that way. It's not about the result. It's about the way that you act. That's what we call a gavra. Versus a cheftza. I'm not getting into that. Another way of understanding this, I think. Yeah, Cherna.
I was going to say, does it matter whom you steal from? Stealing is wrong.
Correct. That's what Shlomo Melech is saying. Stealing from your parents makes you into a thief, regardless of the intention, regardless of the result. Doesn't matter who you're talking about. It's always going to be bad for that person who's now a thief, or more thiefy, if you think that's a word.
I think my mother is trying to think, well, why would there even be a havamina that you have a thought you could take from your parents? I mean, even if they're supposed to give it to you, whatever, but...
Right. Right. You know, I think that's what Shlomo Melech is saying. I don't know. Maybe there's a different way of understanding it. Rashi, as he often does, explains this in terms of Aviv Imo is referring to Hashem and the Jewish people. So I can't really use Rashi's explanation because it doesn't really fit with the... With the pshat, that's more of a drasha. So Mesudas David says, "Ki haloha kol shali hema achar mosam." When my parents die, it's mine anyways. That's how Mesudas David explains it. I'm going to inherit my parents anyway, so I might as well take it now. So yeah, it is that kind of justification. Whether or not we would think like that, hopefully we would never. But that's how Mesudas David explains it. I think there's a different way. A different way to understand this pasuk, which is less nefarious, but just as destructive. And it's, again, it's a drasha. It's not the pshat. But it's something that I've been listening to recently. Gozel ave v'imo, v'yomar ein pesha. When you steal from your parents, what does that mean, steal from your parents? I think in literal terms, it means money. But I think gozel ave v'imo, it doesn't say gozel mi ave v'imo. Gozel aviv imo, basically, I think you could darshan it to mean they're no longer like your parents. You have basically stolen from them their parenthood. This is, again, it's a drush. It's not what the pasuk means, before anyone sort of takes me up on that. It's not what the pasuk means. But gozel aviv imo, you have stolen their parenthood. V'omar in pasha, you'll think there's nothing wrong with, you know, being friends with your parents, for instance. Being on the same level of them, sort of having the parents stoop down. This is a big issue in psychology, not a big issue, but a controversial issue in psychology today. Should parents, when talking to their kids, physically go down to their level? Physically. Should they crouch down to their child level? It's representative and it gives over the message that we're on the same level. And that's how the child interprets it. So what I see this pasuk specifically because I've been listening to a couple things along these lines. Gozel aviv v'imo v'omer in pesha. You might think that losing that sense of parenthood, losing that sense of authority, that maybe there's nothing wrong with it. Maybe it's a good thing. And recently there's been this one woman who's coming out with a book. Her name is Abigail Schreier. She's coming out with a book called Bad Therapy. She was famous for starting controversy a few years ago for putting out a book against transitioning kids from one gender to the other, which you can look up on your own. Now she's making waves because of this book. She was just on a popular podcast by Barry Weiss called Honestly. People can listen to it themselves. Very intriguing concepts, maybe to a little too much to the extreme. But she talks about a phenomenon called today called gentle parenting. You heard of gentle parenting? Kishmel Kenu.
I thought this one.
What?
The modern translation of the word gozel
is to steal.
You know, fledgling, like a little bird in a nest.
Oh, gozel. Gozel is a bird. Gozel is a verb. Yeah, same letters. That's interesting. I wonder if.
Einstein's song of gozel. It's a famous song.
Right, yeah, yeah. I know that word. I know that song. Yeah.
The empty nesters after the birds flown the nest.
Yeah. So that goes out. I wonder if there's a connection. Maybe they're like birds that steal or something. I don't know. I wonder what the connection is.
I was thinking of the cuckoo.
Either way. So Schreier is on now like this media tour where she's going to different podcasts and making this claim that parents have gone too far in the other direction of making their kids feel too comfortable. And children aren't growing up with a sense of friction, the sense of challenge, that they can overcome things. They're not walking outside by themselves anymore, and they're not, you know, being allowed to fail anymore. And they're being sort of outsourced to therapists that are always making them feel good and alienating them from their parents, right? So I think about that just because, again, I'm thinking about it recently. Gozel of Avimo Beomran Pasha. What's so bad about not having such an overbearing parental figure? The truth is, there could be something bad about that. And at least this this woman, Schreier, is trying to make that point to people that parenting has a place, that there's a place to be an authoritative figure with your children, that they should know what it means to do something wrong and to have consequences for it. And they should know what it means to be demanded of something, to have expectations placed upon them, as opposed to just saying, I want my kid to be comfortable. I don't want them, you know, in the words of a mentor of mine that once said, we live in fear of our children's future therapists. We live in fear of our children's future therapists. That's how he said it. That we're so worried that we're going to traumatize our kid. We treat them with like, you know, on eggshells. We'll never make them feel uncomfortable because later on in life, they're going to go to therapy and they're just going to talk bad about their parents and how they were, you know, whatever. So I think there's a balance. Obviously, there's a balance, for some reason, this specific issue has caused, not for some reason, I have my ideas why, but for some reason, it has caused people to just, as usual, polarize, as we talked about last week. You know, the people, and I'm in a mental health professionals group chat for local Detroit, and this was a conversation that was going on literally this morning and today in the afternoon. Obviously, mental health professionals take this a little offensively, right? They're offended by, oh, you're incriminating the mental health professionals. You think it's our fault. So there are some people that had that instinct and therefore felt the need to like eviscerate the whole thing, right? She's saying nothing that's valuable. And other people, kudos to them in the group, you know, they were saying, well, there are certainly worthwhile points to be had here that parents are way, way too off, you know, hands off with their kids. Parents are way too undemanding of their kids. That's a real thing. The kids have to learn resilience. They have to learn to meet expectations and to live with standards and stuff like that. So here, chaver hu l'ish mashkes, that's someone who is allowed, a child who is allowed to steal from their parents, meaning to break down that parental authority hierarchy. That's chaver hu l'ish mashkes. Ultimately, they're going to be a destructive person. Why are they going to be a destructive person? Again, this is drashah, not what the pasuk means. They're going to be a destructive person because they'll grow up thinking that everyone else owes them the courtesy their parents gave them. And they'll grow up thinking that the real world is not supposed to treat them unfairly. And anything that treats them unfairly, they will cry figuratively or literally. And they won't be able to overcome any obstacles. And we've talked about this in the past in terms of also a book, Dopamine Nation, which we've discussed. But ultimately, they will be destructive in the fact they can't relate to other people. Okay, just lastly, we have the pasuk Rechav Nefesh Yigara Madon Uvoteach Al Hashem Yedushan. We don't see Shem Hashem a lot, in especially Yudkei Vavkei a lot in Mishlei. I wonder what the statistics are about that. But he says someone who's Rechav Nefesh. What do you think Rechav Nefesh means? Someone who has a wide spirit. So here, at least in context, what it means is that they they have a lot of taivas. A lot of desires. Rechav Nefesh means they have an ever-widening space for more and more stuff. Like a hoarder. People have seen those shows, hoarders. But my parents are now cleaning out the house, Mirtz Hashem, to make Aliyah this summer. and all the stuff that you accumulate over the years. Oh, I remember this old broken boombox that I thought maybe would be valuable one day. I remember these, whatever, Beanie Babies, or you insert what you thought was going to be valuable here, but it's really never actually valuable. You know, baseball cards and duffel bags and suitcases and all junk upon junk. They just leave in your house. Why? Because maybe one day it'll be, everyone's got that stuff, right? Everyone can relate to that. I'm sure Mayor's got a bunch of wood in the garage about all the broken pieces. Oh, I could make that into something.
He thought he could sell this on eBay.
Right, yeah. What's the point?
He gave things to museums.
Yeah, there you go. Good. So that's Rechav Nefesh. We hoard. So this person, the person that Shlomo Melech is talking about, not necessarily a person that just wants more stuff, but had desires more stuff. I mean, let's talk about like sort of money and greed, like we've been talking about. Yigarem Adon, ultimately, they're just going to cause Midas Hadin. Bad things will happen. That's how they translate it here in the art scroll. It says, a greedy person stirs up strife. Madon is like, start fighting with people. You want more from them. But one who trusts Hashem, Boteach al Hashem Yidushan. What's Yidushan? La'am medushne oneg. What is it?
Prosperity.
Well, or I would say pleasure or sustenance, satisfaction, maybe, right? If a person trusts in Hashem Yidushan, right, sort of a simple idea, not simple, but a well-known idea that if you trust in Hashem, you say, I have what I need, so then you won't need to search out other things. A beautiful phrase here from the Surah 7, and Elizabeth will finish. When a person wants to fill their spirit with a bunch of stuff, a bunch of shefarav is a... How do you translate a flow, a big shefa, abundance, a great abundance,
plenty,
right? He'll start fights because he wants more stuff, right? You think about, you know, people that are chas v'shalom addicted to things. It's a literal, they go into a frenzy when they need to, when they have the possibility of getting something. Why? Fascinating phrase. Al ki yechsar lo b'chol eis. Yechsar, I would say yechaser lo b'chol eis. At every moment in that person's life, what are they thinking about? Not what they have, but what they don't have. Yechsar lo. They're constantly thinking about what they don't have. I once gave a drasha, and I remember the drasha because it was my first drasha in a long time. I remember my first drasha after not giving one for a few months in COVID. My first drasha I gave, and then I stopped giving, but it was for Rosh Hashanah.
You had a drasha every week during COVID.
I wrote one, but I'm talking about my first verbal drasha. That was Rosh Hashanah morning. We had four minyanim, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Four minyanim. I went to every single minyan and gave the same drasha. And part of the drasha was this concept, that we live in scarcity culture. That we wake up in the morning, and what's the first thing we say? I didn't get enough sleep. We walk over to our closet. What do we say? I don't have enough clothes. We go over to the, you know, we go downstairs to eat breakfast. I don't have enough time to eat breakfast. We go into the car. I didn't have enough breakfast, right? I don't have enough time to get to work. You know, everything in life today is about, we don't have enough of this, that, and the other thing. We live in a culture of scarcity. And the irony is, we have such abundance. We have closets full of clothes. We have all the time we need. And yet the way we treat it, the way we look at it, is that we need more of it. And we're constantly saying, I don't have enough of this and that, the other thing. And some of that is, you know, due to social media. Some of that is because we have such abundance, right? And, you know, I'm sure even growing up, you had a different appreciation for the things that you had, right? You understood what your parents went through to get what you get, what they gave you, that kind of stuff. Nowadays, things come with such ease, we have almost an expectation that I should have more. And that's what I think Shlomo Melech is getting at here, that Rechav Nefesh, someone who has widened their spirit, if they've lived in the 21st century America society, where they have so much wealth, so much abundance, so much opportunity, so then Yigara Madon, all they want is to fight and get more of it. But Obuteach Al Hashem, someone who says, I have what I have because Hashem has given me what I need to have. So then Yidushan will be satisfied. An ever-present pursuit of recognizing, well, we have enough, that we have enough. Whenever I have my mind in the right place, I oftentimes think about this when I say the bracha of Hamechin, is it? No, it's Sha'asali Kol Tzarki, that Hashem has given me all the things that I need. Kol Tzarki, all of my needs have been fulfilled. I don't need anything else. What I have is just right for me. The Gemara says, I think I said this before, the Gemara Brachos says that all those brachos used to line up with a different activity in the morning. Nowadays, we wait until we get to shul to say them. But it used to be that you would say that bracha when you put your shoes on. Because a shoe is the type of clothing that you can't wear unless it fits just right. A shirt, you can tie it around the waist and whatever, you can make it fit. Pants, you can tie a little tighter, you make them fit. Shoes, if they're too small, you can't get your foot in. If they're too big, they'll flop around. Right? The shoe has to fit perfectly. You have to do something to change the size of it. But the point is that the shoe has to fit perfectly. And that's what we say, Sha'asali Kol Tzarki, Hashem has given me exactly what I need. Not easy to have that mentality, especially in the world that we live in. But Yidushan, if you can somehow get that mentality, you will feel satisfied by life. And you won't feel the Yechsar B'chol Es, the lacking, the scarcity culture that we live in. You won't feel that scarcity because specifically you'll realize that in fact you have a lot. Okay, I wish you have a great night. Mirz Hashem, continue next week with Legends and Lessons. Legends and Lessons next week.
Thank you.
Hey, Shkaya.